question.
All right. Do you know why child services is called on the neighbors? You know me. Couldn't tell you, but anyone telling their child to walk around with a mullet deserves to have child services try on them. Okay. Not too good tonight. All right. And then she read after with Ed Skoog, and Brian calls that the reading of the Oogs. Because how many people have their last name end in Oog? So he thinks you should go on tour, by the way, both of you. That's the Oogs. All right. Rebecca, who is the author of a chapbook, Grenade, and her poems have appeared in journals such as Poetry, Agony, and Crazy Horse. She is the recipient of fellowships from the McDowell Colony and Artist Trust of Washington State. She won the 2010 Southeast Review Poetry Prize for her poem, Miss Scarlet, a comic look at the tragic Clue character. She received her MFA in poetry and an MA in English from the University of Washington. She is the director of education programs and curator for the poetry series for Seattle Arts and Lectures, and was a co-director of the Summer Creative Writing Program in Rome through the University of Washington in 2009 and 2010. Yep. Please welcome to the stage, Ms. Clue.
I'm going to start by reading my Clue character poem called Miss Scarlet. I had this idea to write a series of sonnets about all the Clue characters, and so I wrote Miss Scarlet, and then I wrote a sort of bad poem about Colonel Mustard, which has not made it out into the world. And then I tried Mrs. White, and I just couldn't get anywhere. It was really boring, Mrs. White. So I have one poem from the series. Miss Scarlet. She's tired of all the accusations, all the whodunit, and what, and where. So there's no Mr. Scarlet to call honey on. So she wears red. So she might be a whore. But sadly, not a murderer. If there's anything to confess, it's that she fell hard for Plum. He used a word, weapon without a playing piece, to shatter her heart. In the billiards room. Now all she wants is to ditch this mansion and get a pied à terre, a church to solve her sins, a little mother of pearl gun, more delicate than that revolver. Shit. The question should be, who hasn't done it? Evolution. I was filling in at the evolution seminar. My job was to handle paperwork, set up the room, assist the professor. How can I help, I said. Well, she said, you can set up the specimens. So I dived with the organic grocery store bags in which she carefully transported our evolutionary ancestors, wrapped like delicate melons, and unswaddled the skulls and jaws, and was particularly enamored by the fetal chimpanzee skull, so wee, so darling. And wanting everyone to have equal access, I scattered the pieces across the tables as if to spread the news across the land, as if I were God, deciding which continents got which species. But it turns out I really spread them out like samples of cheese at said organic grocery store on a high market Saturday, where I was not God, but a minimum wage cheesemonger. For once they were all set out, I alerted the professor, who stepped back from her EV setup and said, now we just have to match the skulls and jaws. The bone that handled brain was over there, the one that would move the words over here. They were disconnected heads that only together would demonstrate how humans put two and two together and got up and walked and thought and said things we felt and decided We needed high-end grocery stores to feed our bodies and brains, which apparently had not done much to feed mine, given how quickly I'd unraveled the lot. If it were possible, I would be descended from that tiny fetal chimpanzee with its minute monkey thoughts and wee ideas. I credit him or her with my first response to everything, my prelingual sense of wonder, all the ooh, oohs, and ah, ahs I've ever uttered, and with my second response, which is, when faced with danger, as I was that day in the seminar room, to back slowly away, then to run and hide, high in the jungle of my palms, the only safe place I've ever known. called my I Wish song, and it was inspired by hearing a This American Life piece where Ira Glass mentions that most musicals and Disney movies, that kind of thing, always begins with what the heroine or hero is wishing for. And so they state in the first song what they wish, or I wish, and then that proceeds to come true. This poem also features my obsession with Little Mermaid. My I Wish song. If you listen carefully, you'll notice my I Wish song is telling you what I want. I sing it to start each day, but the day never finds a producer, and thus the golden egg never results in anything but a golden mess. And my inner mermaid keeps self-destructively ordering the very drink she's in, i.e. the sea, on the rocks, with salt, and thus making the world doubly lovery. Well, my princess is sleeping way too much, the sleep you sleep when you meant to overdose, but which they call accidental to be nice. I'm sorry the day can never remember its lines. Cue harps, horns, waves, I say, cue cards, cue cues, cue A's, cue good grades and good looks, cue good luck and broken leg after leg, even though we all know my mermaid has none. I wish I may, I wish I might, belt it out in a karaoke bar tonight. Whose prize is the sleep of Picasso, even if he's only so-so, in order to inspire his next artistic phase in dog and decor. Just to be something more, just to break through the I Wish door and finally get this woe on the road. So I commute to work, as everybody does in some way, most of us do, maybe it's just for the desk, but I commute particularly bad tonight, wasn't it?
Oh, my.
Blustering.
Yes. This is about so-called commute. The evening's amber alert lights up, modern sunset, another abduction, and fuck, traffic is bad. The girl in the next lane texts while driving, her mouth like the knotted pucker of a helium balloon. Everything electric blows eventually. Light bulbs, crushes, what have you. Even dynamite has fizzled to mean super. Annually, too many people at a party crowd alumni, and it gives way the way one day relates to the next. This summer's collapse is coming up. I commute, but am not moved. That jerk. Sometimes I touch a nerve to see if it still works. This is an oldie. This next one, I wrote it loads many years ago, walking along for a film, and maybe in a month from now, maybe March, April. The title is Lion's Teeth, which is what dandelion means. Lion's Teeth. When others more decorous are bent on composing, crafting the trousseau, 1,000 hands preparing petals, another 1,000 embroidering spores, I admire the indecent burst of the dandelion, the straight-up bloom so soon after snows. Well before the cocktail hour, she is freshly dressed, her cheeks pollen powdered, her feet squeezed into the well-broken earth, and when others are just showing an after-dinner blush, tendril just beginning its unpinnings, she's waving her 4th of July, bearing her lion's teeth. True, she flashes her underside white to the wind sooner than might be thought proper, but she does enjoy the music. And true, she might go to seed before the night is through, but I admire what becomes of her bald bones, milk-sweet spine. When others pull back their petal, allowing only one white petal to show from under the shawl, I can't help but wish that I too could seduce that solo from the sun. A dizzy dance out back, can't help but watch her steps, listen as she calls to him, faster, hotter. So Charlotte mentioned I have got to spend time in Rome the past couple summers, which has been such a huge, huge treat. Though we're mostly spend most of my time teaching on Sundays, my favorite thing to do is to go to the beach. There's two words in here that you may know, you may not. Terracotta means baked earth, and it's sort of the color of kind of caramely colored. And the other term is fior de latte, which means flower of milk. It's the purest kind you can imagine. It's called On the Beach at Anzio, Italy. A man lies on his stomach while his wife, I hope she's his wife, perches above him and gently shaves his ears. What tenderness. What a disgusting display of public grooming. And worse, she really takes her time, wielding the razor as if she is carving him from stone, as if she is Michelangelo, as if he is the piece of marble from Carrara she's been waiting years for. Flawless, though obviously he's not. Purest white, though he's more terracotta than fior de latte. She takes her time as if this is her big commission, her one chance to make her mark, to unseat her rival sculptor, whomever she may be, to please the Pope of their love. She sculpts through the fuzz a clearer sense of himself, ears as intricate as conch shells, ears that he might hold up to his own ears, and hear there the blood that is his blood, and hear her swimming in it, the only fish in his sea, as whatever worries they might have, coarse black qualms of concern, are carried away on the wind, where they come a little too close for comfort to my panini and my beer. Things you can see, things you don't want to see. As was mentioned, I host the poetry series for Sail Arts and Lectures, and I hope you all come next Tuesday to see Marie Howe. She's an awesome, awesome poet, very wonderful writer. And if you are a student type person, tickets are always free, so you can show up night of and get in for free. And if you are not a student type person, you can support the literary arts and buy a ticket and come hear an awesome, awesome poet. She's sort of my first poetry crush, so highly recommend Marie Howe. And one of the cool parts of my job is that I get to hang out with these folks and drive them around, and sometimes they want to do things like go to museums, and sometimes they just want to hide in their hotel rooms. That's okay either way. But this next poem is I don't usually write about what happens in the cars or the museums, but this next poem is about an experience that I had with W.S. Merwin. It's called Small Talk with Big Poet. Merwin and I were at the Asian Museum, looking at the antique bird cages, when I said, very, very stupidly, how beautiful they were. And he said, but think, Rebecca. But think of the birds who live trapped inside. This is how I consistently do not think of anyone but myself, and especially birds, even as I ride them around the sky like a sun god with a marigold for a scepter. Even when there is clapping in an adjacent room, I hope secretly, but now you know, that it is you applauding for me, when it is probably actually the sound of ghost birds trying to get my attention so that I will let them out of their cages. Such beautiful cages. One can never be as good. Okay. Next poem. called, it's an oldie, a goodie. Forgive me if you've heard it before. Hopefully a goodie, an oldie. It's an oldie. Another plot cliche. My dear, you are the high-speed car chase, and I'm the sheet of glass being carefully carried across the street by two employees of a plate glass company, two generic men who have parked on the wrong side of the street because the plot commands that they make the perilous journey across traffic. And so they are cursing as rehearsed as they angle me into the street, acting as if they intend to get me to the department store, as if I will ever take my place as the display window ever clear the way for a special exhibit at Christmas or be indexed once a day, or even late at night be pressed against by a couple who can't make it back to his place. And so they angle me into the street, a bright Laura provocative claim their teaser, and indeed you can't resist my arguments, fatally flawed though they are. So you come careening to butt and rebut, you come careening using both cards, both chaser and chased, both good and bad, both done up with bullets that haven't yet done you in. I know I'm done for. There's only one street on this set, and you've got a stubborn streak a mile long. I can smell the smoke already. No matter, I'd rather shatter than be looked through all day. So come careening. I know you have other cliches to hammer home. Women with groceries to send spilling. Canals to leap as the bridge is rising. And me, I'm so through. I've got a thousand places to be. So a year or two ago, Brandon Davis last at 19 was doing an issue where she wanted to have some food poems, and so she invited myself and Karen Spinnyfrock and a couple others to write some food poems. And I had never at that point written poems really about my mother. When I started thinking about food, the poems all came out. So this is one of them, the least offensive of them, here, I think. The others are not fit for consumption. It's called Beets. Up until that week at the summer house on the beach, the only beets I knew were badly boiled and badly drained. They seeped, infecting the plate's other domains, compromising the independence of mashed potatoes. I despise them, the pink eye of vegetables, the red light district of roots. But here, gem-like in borscht, when served by the mother of my high school boyfriend, when adorned with a fringe of chives and a peony of creme fraiche, when on holiday, my new word for vacation, beets suddenly seemed elegant in an Eastern European way, like Russian models lolling in the shallow end of a pool. She'd done this before, introduced me to Indian food and foreign films on Saturday nights, made me love horsehair couches, want dueling grand pianos in the great room of a house. It was clear I did not want the boy so much as the mother. And so when my actual mother came to fetch me and was asked to stay for lunch, I was snappish, slapping at her hand as she reached for the last piece of bacon, even though she drove 3 hours in uncharacteristic blouse and slacks and flats. Oh, she said, her flake face blousy, let it drop. I was not a nice teenager. So this next poem is a retelling of a part of the Odyssey. It's called The Lost Books of the Obvious. He comes home a decade after a decade of war after his own heart. He homes in on home and arrives without fanfare or sheet cake. Big weight loss, but no banner. You look different, he says to himself in the mirror. We begin in the middle of things, book 12-ish. I'll catch you up after. While you were gone, there was a giant windbag. It was made of leather, but did not contain gold, but hot air, lip gloss, receipts for euros, some backup sales, and all the winds which took him back. That really took him back. And Penelope, Meanwhile, she's been meanwhile all the while, pretending to sleep like a girl who has fallen asleep with a light on and a book on the bed beside her, an invasive weave cracking the spine, which is bad news for her since it's a library book and long overdue. This next poem is probably the only poem that I definitely have ever written and probably will ever write. It's inspired by McDonald's. Inspired by a couple of years ago, they had a billboard campaign. I think it was something like "Fill Your Snack Hole." Gross! Why would that make you want to eat there? So, it made me start thinking about euphemisms for mouth, and so now I have this poem called "Pie Hole," which is almost as gross. And thank you, McDonald's. Pie hole. Volcano to which I throw virgins, 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 in hopes I won't say something I shouldn't. Box of little bones with which I polish other little bones. Cave close to my brain. Hide out for tongue, death, snail, and shell. My petite escargot, which I baste in words I may or may not say. Some are curious, venture out. Some are wallflowers. Some statements have lived in my mouth for years. Hole to other holes, foyer to my body's other closeted closets. Oh, mouth, let's elope and explode. Let's run off together. Just two more. Sex poem called L'œuf, which means the egg in French, and it was inspired by... reading an etymology dictionary like the nerd that I am, and just looked up where what we called love. If you're playing tennis and you zero, you say love for zero, and I was looking into why that was, and this is the story of this is true. So you'll see that. Love. The zero has an eggy form, and so in French they call it l'œuf, which is love. To our oafish ears. We mishear love all over, multiply it like loaf to loaves, like fish to fishes. Me, I've seen lots of loaf than none. Some miracle that was. I was left with a small omelet, with loaf on my face, a little yolk on my sleeve, my shell. I broke a humpy lover. Love is a brunch, a racket. I know it means nothing, barely worth the oofing before the offing, but still I load my basket and watch them hatch, chicklets of zip. Good luck, we're fluff birds. Gag, oof, we're tweetless cheeks. The last one. I was amused a couple years ago. So there's the party, and then there's the after party, but then I was reading, I think, in the style section of the New York Times, that the ending was then the after party. So thinking about what that might mean, and I was quite excited to write a song, but thinking about the after song. After song. Would a hedge be a hedge without its inner edge? Does a thought inherently contain an ought? For a long time, I was young. Then I was not. At heart, there's half a laugh, and a half-hearted even less than that. This particular ticker is bird-brained, inbred, a little too much come hither / dither. The thing is, the thing can't hear itself think. It's a dumb beeper always paging me with its bleeping emergencies. Give it a rest, give it an inch, an ear, and it will take it greedily just to hear itself beat. Na na, na 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 na. Hey, hey, hey. Goodbye.
Oh my God.
Goodbye, thank you.